Well, it is 12:45, so I'd like to call this meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. A quorum is present, I'm told, so welcome everybody. Glad to have you here today. The first order of business will be to entertain a motion to approve the minutes of March 5th, March 10th, and March 11th. And Representative Moran is going to make that motion, right, Representative Moran? She might be muted, but I see she's making that motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
Okay. And then if we could have everybody unmuted for just a moment so that we could vote on that motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right, the motion prevails. Thank you, everybody. So members, we're going to be muted most of the time today, just like before. And we're here today to hear about the arrangement that was reached yesterday between the state and some healthcare entities. We had hoped that the commissioner was going to be here from the Department of Health, Commissioner Malcolm. I understand she's not able to make it, but we do have Mr. Huff here to talk with us about what the plan is, what arrangements were reached, and explain all of that. And then he gets a chance to go through his presentation, explain to us what this is all about. Then we will have an opportunity for member questions. So that is a great part of why we're doing this today. We initially thought we might have legislation that would be moving this forward. As it turns out, the administration's moving forward, as you know, using some of the funds from the COVID-19 fund that the legislature gave the administration the use of in order to move quickly. So we're not needing to do this through legislation. However, of course, the legislature is always going to be involved, and we all need to be up to speed. And this is definitely not going to be the only thing that's going to happen here, and our involvement is going to be critical moving forward from here as well. So we would like to then hold questions, but please do, if there's something, as always, that needs clarification, let us know right away. We will be keeping a list. You can use the raise the hand function if that doesn't work for you. If you're kind of waving your hand in the screen, hopefully Ms. Niedernhoff or Mr. McQuillan will be able to pick that up and put you on the list as well. So if there's something that needs clarification, go ahead and ask when that pops up. Otherwise, let's hold questions to the end, and then we should have four questions and discussion. Also, I want to note that the governor is having the 2:00 briefing, which is 15 minutes, starts 15 minutes before we would be ending this committee. I'm going to try, if we can, to get done a little bit early so that you can all have the opportunity to go and listen to that briefing, because I'm told that there will be things that are announced that are going to be of particular interest. I mean, that is always of interest, certainly to this committee. I hope many of you are watching that on a regular basis, but if you're not, this would be a good day to do that. So with that, I want to welcome Mr. Huff again from the Department of Health, and thank you so much for joining us, and please go ahead and give your presentation.
There, I think I was still muted. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Dan Huff. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm pleased to follow up on the conversation we had last week about testing, let you know how we are beginning to really strategy.
Mr. Having a lot of getting a lot of distortion. I don't know if other members are as well. Can you all hear him okay? Because I'm having a lot of difficulty. Okay, I see some. Okay, maybe it's on my end then. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Huff.
Okay. Hopefully I'm actually in my office now, so hopefully the Wi-Fi here works well. I apologize if it does not. But I wanted to update you on the agreement that was reached and announced yesterday, what that means, and what else we are going to be working on with testing. First of all, I would like to just share a slide with you. Let's see. I'd like to just show you one of the reasons that, that's the wrong one. Actually want to share a different, is it possible to share a different slide? Whoever is the host of the meeting. Maybe not.
Well, I think he's working on it, Mr. Hupp. Hold on a second.
I haven't sent it to him. That's why I was just hoping to share it from my screen. But if we look at how testing has been done in Minnesota, testing has really been dependent upon the capacity of each individual health system. And so what we have seen is statewide, depending on where you live and depending on who your health provider is, you may have different access to testing. So someone who lives in the southern part of the state and goes to a clinic operated by Mayo would have really great capacity, great access to getting tested, where someone else, say in the metro or central Minnesota, would have very little access to testing. Well, that's a problem. We also have not only geographic differences, but we had the inability to reach all of our priority populations in becoming tested. We had a real Gordian knot of what was the problem with testing, and it stems from a lack of supplies. We had really severe issues in supply chain at the very beginning of this, and we've begun to parse out and provide extra supply around the state, but that was not distributed evenly. We have, especially at Mayo Clinic and now at the university, the capacity to significantly ramp up the amount of testing that can be done. What this agreement that we were able to make with Mayo and the University of Minnesota that was announced yesterday, this agreement gives us the access of that capacity at Mayo that was only available for southern Minnesota is now open statewide, while still supporting individual health systems in building their own individual capacity. So what the goal of this was to create a statewide access to testing, not just dependent upon where you live or what healthcare system you belong to. And this has been a partnership and is a collaboration with all of the healthcare systems, the major healthcare systems in the state. So I wanted to talk about what this agreement has in it and then what we're going to continue to do that was not part of this agreement. So first is it will establish a statewide testing command center. We want to make sure everyone has access to testing and that the supplies are where they need to be. So we'll have this virtual command center. It'll be led by Mayo, the university, and MDH, and it will have representatives from all the healthcare systems. What we'll do, this is, it's really about logistics. It's about, do you have enough capacity in-house in your lab at your hospital? If not, how do we get you the test kits you need to be able to ship them either to the U or to Mayo so that we can meet those testing demands that you, health system, have for your patients? We also are going to, and so part of that is that whole logistical interface. We are going to be, I'm skipping over my notes here. That command center will ensure that the testing capacity throughout the state is utilized. We will have the ability to do hotspot sampling. So if we have an outbreak anywhere in the state and it exceeds the capacity of the healthcare system, we, partnering with the University of Minnesota and local public health, will be able to send sampling teams from the medical school and from local public health and MDH to collect samples and do hotspot testing if we have localized outbreaks that exceed local capacity. We're also going to be making sure that we are very conscious, as we always are, in how do we protect data. So we are not collecting DNA. We are not collecting personalized data beyond what is necessary from the clinical setting, but also to make sure that we're achieving our goals. So we are asking voluntarily for folks to contribute demographic data so that we make sure that we are effectively serving all of our communities. We always have the clinical information, which is needed to make sure someone is treated. This is all HIPAA protected. This allows then MDH to do follow-up with contact tracing disease investigation. We're going to be doing through this agreement, starting a seroprevalence study. That is using serology to see how many people have had the disease. We're going to start actually looking at blood banks, since that's a really source of blood, testing blood banks through the University of Minnesota for how many samples the antibody is present in. And that would give us an idea of how many people who donated blood have had and recovered from the disease. Some of the things that are not covered in this that we are going to continue to work on. One is we are going to be developing a website so that anyone who needs testing goes on the website and can find out where they, as a member of whatever health plan, go, where they need to go to get testing. We're going to also have a real focus on vulnerable populations, and this is where our partnership with local public health and our partnership with local healthcare systems is going to be so important. Representative Moran, last week you asked about how are we prioritizing communities of color, and I appreciate that input because we've got that squarely on our plan, not just assumed but explicitly mentioned. So we're going to be working with health corps organizations to make sure we're, how do we set up clinics, testing clinics to test people who experience homelessness? How are we going to do targeted testing within communities of color, working with Department of Corrections to really expand our testing in prisons and the staff serving the prisoners? How are we going to really ramp up our testing in long-term care? These are all things that have to be operationalized that are the continuation of this process. Now that we've opened up the testing limitations, we now have to implement getting these targeted testing clinics and operations done. Part of that will be then testing our critical workforce. So people that work in meatpacking plants, that work in grocery stores, that metro bus drivers, folks that are working in the utility sector, making sure that these folks are tested. And then a really big part of this is case investigation. So last week I shared the analogy of we're on a mountain, we're in a truck on a mountain, we're going down this mountain, and our social distancing, our stay-at-home measures, that's putting the brake on the truck, and we don't want to lift that brake too fast. But as we begin to lift the brake, we also need to be able to put the truck into low gear. Contact tracing puts us into low gear so that we do not get going too fast down that mountain. And the way this works is if someone tests positive, we follow up, an epidemiologist or case investigator follows up and interviews that person. And we make sure that that person is isolated until the disease, until they're free of the disease. But we ask them who they've been in contact with, what are their close contacts. Then we contact those contacts, interview them. If they're symptomatic, we make sure they get tested, and otherwise they're in quarantine. So those folks need to be quarantined for 14 days. What that does is it contains the virus. It prevents that spread that keeps multiplying from person to person, because we break that chain by having people isolate and quarantine. It's really important. That is going to require a lot of people. We have right now 100 people, actually 97 people at MDH who are doing contact tracing. We estimate we're going to have 400 to 500 people doing this. So we're going to have to get a lot more people hired and trained to do contact tracing. We may not hire all these folks ourselves. We may, in partnership with the university and students at School of Public Health, utilize our partners in local public health and utilize existing MDH staff. We're working through that, but that is definitely something that we are now ramping up so that we can do that contact tracing as we expand our testing statewide. And we're going to be doing, I talked last week about how testing provides headlights as we're going down this mountain in the night, in the dark. And so part of this will be surveillance, which allows us to see how quickly is the disease spreading and how widespread is it, both with the serology as well as the molecular testing. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hopp. We appreciate that. And I'm sure that we're going to have some questions, but I don't see any yet. So, okay, I see Representative Moran is waving her hand. Oh, I do see that there are some hands up. So I'm going to let the staff tell me. Okay, very good. So Representative Moran, you are first.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. To Commissioner Hopp, in regards to testing, so one, I think, you know, when you look at the low-income communities and communities of color, utilizing community health clinics will be a great way of creating access to testing. And I'm just wondering, if a person has been, is positive, and them and all of their contact tracing individuals are also in quarantine for 14 days. The process has been is that the only person who has been made positive has to do another test. Now with this statewide testing, will all the other contact tracing individuals be allowed to be tested too?
Mr. Hupp.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, that is what we are aspiring to. We would like that anyone who is a contact is also tested. Now, we are going to be, it is a ramp up, so we're not there yet, but that is what we are aspiring to.
Representative Moran?
Chair Liebling, okay, so you are in this beginning process of this. Do you know when this would be made available? Is it, no, this is like COVID-19. This is like in the urgency of now. So it, does it take a few days? It's going to take a week? You know, what is the expectation that at the minimum that we can get those folks who are also being in contact, being quarantined, can also get, because they're scared, right? They want to know whether or not they can go to work, whether or not they are, you know, after even 14 days, you're not even positive that you are not still positive because they've never been tested. So what do you think soon we can get this up and going?
Mr. Hopp.
Chair, Representative Moran. So really two questions there. One is how fast is this going to ramp up? And the answer is I don't know, but I know it's happening already. 2 days ago, we reported out, I think, about 800 and something tests were done statewide. Today, we reported out over 2,200 tests were performed statewide. So we had one of our largest days yesterday of testing. And that's just with the announcement and the agreement of the all the healthcare coalition that, yes, we are making tests available. So we're moving away from scarcity. I imagine we'll see every day now increases in the amount of testing that's being performed. But the second question is around quarantine. The way the disease works, it usually takes about 5 days, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, but an average of 5 days after exposure to develop symptoms. And the way that our molecular testing works is there has to be enough virus inside of me so that when that swab is stuck up my nose, it gets enough virus on it that the test will be tested positive. I could actually test negative and still be infected. It's just I'm so early in the infection that it hasn't really begun to multiply and give me enough of a load to test positive. So unfortunately, even if someone is tested negative, they would still have to stay in quarantine because we want to see if they develop symptoms and develop the positive test because as the virus sort of multiplies, it takes a little bit of time.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Huff. So let me just let everyone know I have Representative Moran, Cantrell, Halverson, Keel, and Haley on the list. So Representative Moran, were you finished or did you have another follow-up?
Stop there for now.
Okay. So we will go then to Representative Mann.
I just wanted a better picture of how this logistically is going to work. So you said that, you know, a patient goes onto this website and they can find out where they're going to get tested. But if a patient, you know, doesn't feel good and they go to the doctor, which is what most people are going to do, they're going to go see their doctor and not check a website first, I think. They go to their doctor. Will their doctor be able to test them without going to the website first?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative Mann, great question. So let's say I'm not feeling well. I'm going to call my doctor because I have to get an appointment, or I'm going to call the urgent care, and they're going to ask me questions about how I feel. And then they will say, okay, here's where you need to go because we think you need to get tested. Some clinics will offer, you know, maybe my clinic does offer testing, or maybe I'm a member of Health Partners. You know, maybe my clinics, they'll say, okay, you need to go over. We've designated a specialized area. Maybe it's a drive-in. Maybe it's a particular setup of a clinic where you go. Think about it as how you access care now. Your home clinic will do a lot of things, but maybe for an MRI, for example, your home clinic probably doesn't have the MRI. They may make an appointment for you somewhere else. It'd be the same thing for COVID testing. Some clinics will have COVID testing there, but depending on how the healthcare system is arranging that, it may mean you have to go to a different site for that. Did that help answer your question, Representative?
Representative Mann?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and then how will the patient be charged for that COVID testing? Have we spoken to the health plans? Are they covering this? Is the state covering it? How are people going to get, how are they going to pay for it?
Great question. Mr. Huff.
Chair Liebling, Representative Mann, I'm not a health insurance expert. However, the health plans will be paying for it, and there is no copay for testing because of recent changes in CMS guidance from Centers of Medicaid and Medicare. That reimbursement is up to $100 per test. Anyone will be covered through their insurance for testing.
Representative Mann?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I do just want to mention that we also have folks on this call from Mayo and from the U of M if there are any more technical questions or questions that any members wanted to direct toward those institutions. Next on our list is Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for joining us today. And this may fall under that kind of more technical question category. Mr. Huff, last when our committee met, you outlined some of the testing accuracy issues in terms of the rate of error on these tests. So I guess my question to you or to anybody else who may be able to answer is, how are we controlling for that rate of error? Have there been advancements made recently that would give us a clearer picture in terms of the accuracy of testing? And then my just one other subsequent question is, Dr. Tolar mentioned in the press briefing yesterday that it sounds like the University of Minnesota and or Mayo Clinic are developing kind of homegrown tests in Minnesota that cut out some of the supply chain difficulties that we've experienced in terms of acquiring testing supplies. So if anybody's able to speak to these components, just I just want to get a better understanding of what we're looking at right now.
So thank you, Representative Cantrell. So let's start with Mr. Huff, and then because this is such an awkward format, maybe Mr. Huff, if you think that one of the institutions would be better able to answer, why don't you let me know that and we can go to one of the other folks on the call. So Mr. Huff, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So first of all, no medical procedure is 100%. So there's always a margin of error. And as I outlined, there could be a larger margin of error depending on how sampling and viral load. That's why our public health measures have to be such that, so if someone is in quarantine, as I explained earlier, they have to stay in quarantine even if they have a negative test because we're not 100% sure that they may not have the virus. It just hasn't developed enough yet. We can't guarantee 100%. I wish we could. We're going to get better at that. Widespread getting out there and testing, we're going to get catch a lot more people than if we weren't testing. A lot more folks will know if they're positive. To the second question, I believe Dr. Tolar was talking about the serologic tests that have been developed in-house. However, I'll let my colleagues at the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic, and I might turn it, I think Dr. Pratt is on the line from Mayo Clinic. I know she's looked a lot into testing accuracy. Dr. Colleen is also on the line from the University of Minnesota Health Lab. So I'll turn it over to one of them to maybe dive into more detail on these questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Hupp. And so it's hard in this format to sort of open up the floor. Who wants to try to take that? And if you could just introduce yourself to us. Let's go to Dr. Killeen, I think it is. Welcome. Yes,
that's right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm Tony Killeen. I'm the director of the clinical labs at the East Bank University Hospital here in Minneapolis and the vice chair of the academic department of lab medicine and pathology. And Dean Tolar is my boss, so I'll follow up on what he said. So to Representative Cantrell's question, yes, every test can have an error, and there are two distinct types of error. One is what we call a false positive, and the other is a false negative. So a false negative means somebody has the infection, but we give them a negative result, so that's a false negative. And the other mistake that can happen, or error that can happen in lab testing, is somebody does not have the disease, but we say that they do, that's a false positive. So in developing the tests at the University of Minnesota, we've developed what we call lab-developed tests. Some people call them homebrew tests. But for both the molecular and the serologic, we followed the FDA guidelines for validation of the assays, and we submitted our data to the FDA. In the case of the molecular one, which went in for an emergency use authorization, the FDA in the interim had changed their guidance and came back and said we didn't need to get EUA. It was optional at this point, but our intention is to go ahead and do that. And for the serologic assay, we're also planning on getting an EUA approval from the Food and Drug Administration. So currently, our understanding is that for the molecular assay, which is based on the CDC assay, that the sensitivity of the method is 95% if there is virus in the sample. Now, that's a big if, because a lot of that depends on the collection technique and how aggressively one swabs the nasopharynx, and that's not a very pleasant procedure for anybody, and the patients sort of begin to push back against it. But if it's a properly collected sample with virus and the patient has a reasonable level of virus that we can detect, then we think it's got 95% sensitivity, meaning that we will detect at least 95% of people who do have virus. The specificity for that test, we think, is over 99%. This is a very highly specific, in other words, a low false positive rate. For the serologic assay, again, we have very high sensitivity and specificity in the order of at least 97% for the sensitivity and over 99% for the specificity. So we judge these based on our own lab validations. And again, this is reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. We hope that there will shortly be coming what we call proficiency testing samples from the major. The proficiency test is one that we get from an external agent. They send us the sample blinded. We test it as we would a patient sample and submit the results back. It's an external quality control measure for our lab. Every lab, accredited lab in the US in the high and moderate complexity categories have to do this. We expect that they will be issuing those kinds of proficiency testing materials soon, which will allow for a national and broader assessment of the quality of the labs. Right now, we think our sensitivity and specificity are certainly adequate for clinical use at this time. So I hope Representative Cantrell, that answers your question.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Killeen. And did our Mayo person want to also speak to this? If you wanted, had something you wanted, you're still muted though. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Bobby Pritt, and I'm a physician and clinical microbiologist at Mayo Clinic, part of the team that's been working on our two types of tests that Dr. Killeen has already nicely mentioned, the PCR test and the serology. Like the university, we have tests that we've internally validated, and they both have excellent sensitivity and specificity. So the risks of a false negative and false positive from the test itself is quite low. However, I will echo what Mr. Huff said, which is if you don't collect a specimen well, or if you collect the wrong specimen at the wrong time of the disease, then you could get a false negative or false positive. So for example, we know that the PCR test is good for acute disease when patients have symptoms, but it's most likely to be positive during the first 3 to 5 days of illness. So someone after the first week or two may not be positive by PCR. The opposite is true for serology. I'm sure you all know this, but serology is detecting the host's immune response, and it takes at least 7 days, more like actually 14 or 15 days to reliably detect a response. So those, I think, are some of the confounders when people start talking about false negatives and false positives, that you first have to ask, are they using the right test and at the right time of disease? The tests themselves that Dr. Killeen and I have at the university and at Mayo Clinic, both analytically have very high sensitivity and specificity.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I think it really emphasizes how important it is for us to have a functioning integrated system where we get the highest quality at each stage in order to make this all really work. So members, we have now, just to tell you who's on the list, next is going to be Representative Munson. Then I have Halverson, Keel, Haley, Schultz, and Bierman. So we will go next to Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. I wanted to follow up on the accuracy of the tests. You know, last week we discussed some numbers about potentially 70% false negatives, mostly due to the way that it was being collected and the timing, which I think we just discussed here. But my concern is around the policy of perhaps allowing workers to work only if they have a negative test. And, you know, even if that's what the policy is going to be going forward from the Department of Health, or issuing people certificates saying they tested negative, when this is such a moving target. I mean, somebody can be exposed 2 days later, get a test that shows they're negative or were at the time, but they technically are a carrier of the virus. So I appreciate trying to, you know, do more testing, but I'm really concerned about policy. Allowing businesses to open or allowing people to work based on these tests. Is that, Mr. Huff, is that what you feel like the MDH is going forward with, policy to use a test in this manner?
Yeah, great question for Mr. Huff. Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, you're exactly right. these tests should not be used for employment verification purposes. The purpose of these tests are for clinical reasons, so that as you seek treatment from your doctor or medical provider, and for public health reasons as to how we do contact tracing, making sure that infected people are isolated, their contacts are quarantined, and for us to have an idea of what's the prevalence and rate of the disease in the state. They should not be used for employment purposes.
Okay, and just
Representative Munson.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hupp, I've been talking to a lot of people concerned about protecting the state's most vulnerable, which is what I think we all want to do, and perhaps testing workers in long-term care facilities. Again, if we were to give somebody a test every single day, it still isn't going to protect the people in this facility, since the timing is so important and when we catch that. Can you just confirm?
Mr. Hupp?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson. So if I'm a worker at a long-term care, if I'm a worker anywhere and I test positive, I will be isolated. So that means I have to stay home. So I can't work then, but it's not about being denied work. That's about being in isolation from public health reasons. Now, you're exactly right. I can test negative today and test positive tomorrow, depending on where the virus is, you know, and how much it's developed inside of me. What we want to do, though, is by having more frequent tests of folks who are working with vulnerable populations. Right now, we're completely in the dark. What testing does is it sort of you flash on the lights for a minute and then turn them off again. So at least we're getting some vision and some idea of where we are. And so testing's not perfect, but it is much better than no knowledge at all.
Okay, thank you. Representative Halverson. Representative Halverson, we're not hearing you if you're speaking, so I don't know if you're muted. Okay, I'm not hearing Representative Halverson, so why don't we go to Representative Keel, and then we'll come back to Halverson. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like to know is we had a little bit of a brief conversation about long-term facilities and the employees that we would be testing. What about the long-term facilities themselves, the residents there? Mr. Hupp, do you know if you're planning on testing and how you would go about that in light of how testing is anyway? I'm thinking that maybe employees might have been infected by residents, or, you know, it just goes through long-term care facilities so fast. How would you handle that?
Mr. Hupp?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't give you the specifics because I'm not working closely with the long-term care team. I know we have a multidisciplinary team and multi-agency team that has really stood up to address issues with long-term care and how do we protect those folks. So as far as I know that we are going to be having a much more targeted strategy in long-term care. This is part of that development phase of what we need to continue to work at. Now that we have expanded testing capacity, how do we best utilize that testing capacity to protect people in vulnerable populations? I don't have the answer for you right now, but I can talk with our long-term care team and see what that's going to be.
Representative Keel?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and I think it would be very beneficial for us as legislators to know what is being planned and how we're dealing with it. I see a lot of people talking to family members via windows outside, and thank goodness it's finally 60 degrees here, so we're appreciating the warm up. But I think that the mental health of some of those residents is being jeopardized by the isolation. I certainly understand it, but it would be nice to know how we're going to handle this and how the facilities themselves are going to handle taking care of their residents. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Keel. So members, we have next is Haley, then Schultz, Bierman, and Hamilton. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you can extrapolate a little bit, Dr. Huff, on your comment that tests shouldn't be used for in an employment situation. We do have businesses that are partially open. We hope to obviously get more on a ramp up to open. So can you talk more about the role that employers will play, or will they play no role in helping to ramp up testing? Especially we do have employers who are have the resources and are willing to do that to support a safe work environment. So I would just like some more clarification on where you see that heading. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative. So we need to do more testing. And however we do that, whether it's through employee-sponsored testing strategies, you know, maybe we could see, like, you know, you have a flu clinic at your work site. Maybe we have a testing clinic. We need to ramp up testing. Now, we may, and we're part of the study, or part of what we have, the agreement that we have now with Mayo and the university, is to study testing more in depth. So part of the and this is part of my caution on using testing for work, is there's sort of a conception out there that if I test positive for serology, for a serologic test, that I've had the infection or I have the antibodies, that somehow I have a get out of jail free card and I can just do whatever and I'm no longer can get it, no longer can spread it. We need to study that and we need to make sure. So part of the work that the University of Minnesota, that Mayo Clinic, that we at MDH, what we will be doing is looking at what does serologic tests tell us about someone's continued to exposure to the disease? Do they have immunity to the disease? Can they be a carrier of the disease? Those types of things. There's a lot more for us to learn that in the future, maybe we can use it in a workplace setting. But right now, just with the nascent science, we just can't say that. But I definitely understand that businesses want to get back to work and want to do everything they can through testing, but testing is more of a public health strategy. It's putting that truck into low gear so that the entire truck is going down the mountain slowly, not necessarily about the individual in the truck. If that analogy is carrying, I'm not sure.
Does that help, Representative Haley?
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you. Answering that. So just if I'm correct in for advising companies what they need to be prepared for, that their focus will be on masks and social distancing and sanitizing protocols, that right now their role is not to be concerned about testing. Is that a fair conclusion to your remarks?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative, testing will definitely help because if their employees are infected and test positive, they need to be isolated and we need to quarantine their contacts. We don't want to continue to spread, have someone who is maybe asymptomatic or only slightly symptomatic spreading the disease at the workplace. But to your point, yes, it's these other measures that we need to make sure. That's why even with testing, social distancing is still very important. Our stay-at-home measures are still very important. So we can't just now that we say, oh, we have testing, we don't just open the doors and everything returns to normal. You know, Dr. Osterholm talked about it yesterday and said, you know, we're in the, there's a lot more innings to this that we're going to see. So this is going to be the long haul. This gives us a valuable tool to slow us down going down the mountain, but we still have to get to the bottom of the mountain.
Yeah, so I think Representative Haley, you know, what I'm understanding is there's no direct role in testing for employers, but I think we also need to remember that our hospitals and our, you know, are also employers. And so I'm sure they'll be using testing, you know, with healthcare providers. I'm sure that will be a little bit different, but, you know, maybe we will see a day when testing will be so prevalent that employers, every employer will be doing it. Who knows? So we are now up to, it'll be Schultz, Bierman, Hamilton, Franson. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So I have a few questions. You know, testing is really important, but I think this contact tracing, we need to do that almost immediately if we want to be successful and open our economy back up and reduce fatalities. So as chair of the long-term care division, I hope we can ramp up testing immediately in our long-term care facilities. But I'm just wondering what contact tracing looks like. You mentioned needing 500 people. That seems low to me, but how many people can be contacted by one FTE of a contact tracer? And what does the training look like? Is the University of Minnesota, do they have an online training out of the box that can be used currently to train novice people to do mm-hmm. contact tracing? I have a lot of retired people in my district that have sent me messages that they are willing to do contact tracing for free as volunteers. I have a lot of students, senior undergraduates that are willing to do it, want the experience. People really want to help. So how can we engage those individuals to get trained now to do the contact tracing that will be so vital? And then my other question is, are we going to pursue using our smartphones and an application to track where we are and people who are in that vicinity? I think someone mentioned it at the press conference, but are we going down that path? Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Schultz. What a great question. I mean, Minnesotans love to step up and do their part. So, Mr. Huff, what do you think?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for reminding me of the generosity that we have in Minnesota and the ready volunteers. First of all, I'll let you know how I calculated 400 or 500 contact tracers. If we're going to be doing 20,000 tests a day, I estimated that at a 10% positivity rate, and then each contact tracer can contact 4 to 6 people a day and do those interviews on average. And so from there, it ends up being between, you know, 400 and 600 people. To your point of how do we train folks? So there is nuance to this. We do want people that have some background in either public health or medical science, because there's a lot of questions that people have when they're called, because it's concerning. You know, you can imagine it's a little disconcerting to get a call from someone that says, I'm with the health department, and you have been in contact with someone that tested positive for COVID. So that is difficult news to deliver. There's strategies that we have, and then we have to prepare for a lot of questions that folks have. So we currently have 97 people from the Department of Health who are doing this, and we're going to begin to ramp these up. And first, we'll be tapping in probably School of Public Health, our local public health colleagues, other colleagues in the Department of Health. I think that however we can tap into the resources of our Minnesota community are always important to do. And then to your third point about the app, there are a number of apps out there. I know that the iPhone has an app you can download. Unfortunately, Apple doesn't share those data with us. So we can't use that from a public health purpose. but obviously people can use it themselves. It's sort of, a social media approach to doing crowdsourced epidemiology, maybe.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up?
So did you say that are you developing this online training for contact tracers? Is that being developed now, or do we have something ready? Is this something the university is working on currently?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. I did not answer that question. So we don't have, I'm not sure what our training protocol is going to be. We're just developing that. It's a good question. I'll find out.
Okay, thank you for that. And so on this issue about apps, and I thought I had at one point seen something that Mayo Clinic had a partnership around that, or was, I don't know if I'm misremembering that. Dr. Pritt, do you know if there's something happening in that space with some kind of app to trace contacts? And I thought it was in the very early stages. I don't know if that was something Mayo was working on.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I don't.
Okay.
There may be someone working on it.
Okay, I know. It's a very big organization, I know. Okay, so next we have Representative Bierman, then Hamilton, Franson, and Knorr. So Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Huff, for being here today. I appreciate all the conversation and the good questions and all the kind of the nuance you have to approach this whole epidemiology field with in figuring out answers to a lot of these questions. And I just, I'm still feeling really good about yesterday when this alliance was formulated between the U of M, Mayo, and the Minnesota Department of Health. So thank you for all your work on that. And thanks for educating us and everybody in the public. So I did want to follow up on one question that was asked already from Representative Cantrell, and this is in regards to the success of this alliance and the capacity it brings to all the things we need to do this, the reagents, the labs, the swabs, the power that the U of M and Mayo bring for outside supply sources. And also, I did hear that the U brings to the table some uniqueness in that they don't rely on so many outside sources. You did elaborate on some of that, or somebody from the U did. I just wondered, as this goes on, as this need for raw materials continues, does the University of Minnesota and Mayo have more special products that they have that they're using that other labs aren't? And that ensures our supply worldwide as this demand continues in some way? Is that what I was to understand from that conversation? If anybody could comment, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I think Dr. Killeen wants to weigh in on that. Dr.
Yes.
Killeen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, for the question. So here at the university and at Mayo, we have a lot of research activity that sort of in some ways overlaps with our regular clinical activities that you wouldn't find typically in a regular community hospital. It's one of the differentiators of academic institutions is that in the regular research work we do there, we are developing tests often for research applications, but sometimes they can overlap with clinical applications. And so we've brought up actually a combination of methods for the molecular testing. So we have both the lab-developed test that I alluded to earlier, and we're also using two commercial instruments, one from DSR and one from Cepheid. These are large manufacturers in the in vitro diagnostic space that provide kits. The latter type of kit would be system would be used typically all over in both academic hospitals and in community hospitals across the world. And there, one is dependent to a greater extent on the availability of the actual test cartridges or test kits from the manufacturer to be delivered to your hospital in order to run the test. In the case of assays that come out more from the research world, typically the supplies for those, the reagents, the raw chemicals for those are typically more readily available. In the past number of weeks, we have actually seen shortages of those sorts of reagents too. So it's not that, you know, the research world is immune from the shortage of basic raw materials, but having our own test system allows us a little bit more flexibility than relying exclusively on commercial vendors to deliver kits to us. I don't know, Representative Bierman, if that helps to answer. Well, it
definitely helps.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. It definitely helps to have a little more detail, so I appreciate that. I wanted to just ask also on the whole thing about tracing, which I'm understanding more and more clearly how that's part of the solution to get people back to work. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, I look at South Korea, how they've done massive testing, tracing. They've had far fewer deaths than the rest of the world per capita. And so I look at that model and I'm heartened to know that we here in Minnesota are on that same track. But I am also concerned, like many of us, about long-term care. And I'm wondering how soon, I know you're into the execution phase of this and it's going to take some time still, but the vulnerable communities and our care centers, you know, how important that is to get testing out. And that's what I'm hearing from those directors is we need testing faster. And so, you know, anything you can do to get that out there sooner would be helpful. And in relation to that, I have one question about whether through MDH there's any mandate program or thoughts about creating, whether it's overflow of COVID patients or will there be COVID developed sites adjacent to nursing homes. And I just wanted to ask if that was any sort of policy in the works for that. If it's a concern of mine, if there are facilities being turned over to that, I understand they need places to go and that's skilled nursing care and maybe that is the best place, but could you enlighten me on what's afoot there, please?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair and Representative, again, I'll have to talk with the long-term care strategy folks and we'll have to get back to you. I don't want to misspeak on the in-depth because I know there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people as we focus in on how to protect these most vulnerable Minnesotans. So I will have to, we'll have to get back to you on really are all the work we're doing with long-term care.
So I could just add to that that pot of money that we appropriated for grants that MDH is now working on that second piece, the $150 million. I remember part of the discussion when that was all put together was around whether some long-term care facilities might actually need to stand up separate wings, additional beds, things like that. So yeah, I also would like to know how that's being used or if there's a plan there, because certainly it was intended that we had some funds out there for just that thing. Okay, Representative Bierman, did you have any follow-up or should we go to Representative Hamilton next?
You can move on, please. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, more of a message to the Department of Health, the Mayo Clinic, and the University of Minnesota. As we're listening, and I know it takes time and we need to wrap this up, and everybody's focused on keeping people safe. In the meantime, in agriculture, I represent the city of Worthington. We have a large pork producing plant down there, which kills 20,000 hogs a day. We have a number of plants now that are shut down, and I've been told upwards of 170,000 hogs per day may have to be euthanized and placed into a hole, their carcasses either buried or burned. We're dumping raw milk out because we don't have a place to go with it. We are euthanizing over 65,000 hens at a time because we don't have places to go with them. And it's reported that we have thousands of acres of vegetables being plowed under because we can't find employees to harvest them. It's very real, and this will impact every single one of us if we continue destroying our food supply. So I just can't stress the urgency enough. Again, I want to thank everybody for what they're doing, from the governor all across the board. But I just would be beside myself if I didn't stress the urgency around all of this, because this is very, very real. People are filing bankruptcy out here, and farmers are being destroyed along with their crops and livestock and flock. So again, I'm just stressing the urgency. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hamilton. I think there was some thought early on by some that this was an urban problem. And clearly it is not. This is everybody's problem. And it shows us how very intertwined we are. And even going to the problem of workforces and who's available to work and all of that, we are very intertwined. And I just want to put in a plug here that we have to operate as one system. And I'm glad to see that we're starting to do that a little bit more. But there were people among us, for example, people who were undocumented, were very much part of our economy. And if somebody gets sick and they are infectious, it doesn't matter what their status is, it doesn't matter what their income is, what their station in life is, we are all connected together. So I think this is really showing us that we need to operate as a system and kind of put aside these divisions because we're all human beings and we're all intertwined right now and with our food system and urban rural, and this is just a moment to understand all of that. Okay, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just want to highlight the wonderful partnership the state has with the U and Mayo. So just kind of thinking about our rural hospitals here and facilities. So let's just use, we'll use Alamare Health in Alexandria here, right? So they collect a sample. They send it into either the U or the Mayo. How much will that charge be? How much will they be billed? And will the reimbursement from the $100 reimbursement from the state, right, or the health, however that works, will that actually cover the charge of the fee that will be charged to Alamare Health for actually administering or sending it in for that sample to be tested? If it doesn't cover, let's say Alamare gets reimbursed $100 and the U or the Mayo charge $150. And so that then the hospital is losing $50 on that. What I don't want to see is that the hospital, like, you know, we're already losing money and feeling like they don't want to offer a lot of tests for the fear that they are losing money by doing this. Okay, so that's my one question. And then when can the community, rural hospitals, et cetera, expect to see more testing to be able to offer this to their community members? And I think that's good.
Okay, thank you, Representative Franson. Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Franson, I will defer to the University of Mayo as to the cost that they will charge. However, we are looking at billing issues. We want to make sure that billing is not a roadblock, because we understand that healthcare system they can't front load this. They need to be reimbursed in order to continue to provide this service, especially in our rural communities where that financial margin of error can be quite slim. But to your point of when we will see it, so the first, we want to build capacity at hospital labs as well. We have our hospital systems have their own labs throughout the state, and we want to build up that capacity. This is not just about sending everything to Mayo or the U. The Mayo or the U are they're the backup. And by expanding that capacity, we have that backup so that folks know that they can go ahead and if they exceed their own capacity, they know there's somewhere to go to a relief valve. Now, as to when each healthcare system, so the system you mentioned in Alexandria, when will they be able to stand that up? We're right now working with all of them. This is what that command center will also help, is to find out, can you stand up now? What are you missing? We have a full-time staff person who is working on nothing but supply chain issues trying to find the supply. We actually had, speaking of Minnesotans stepping up, yesterday, Be the Match donated 35,000 swabs to this state, which we're now redistributing out to health care. So we're already doing this function, and we want to continue that because it's a two-stage thing. You have to have the lab capacity, but you have to have the clinical capacity to take the sample. So we're working on it in both ends. But the answer is when that's going to happen, I don't know specifically.
All right. Well, thank you. Representative, I think that's a great question. I also am curious about how that's going to work, but I don't want to ask our two experts on today because I know that that isn't their area. We've got our technical experts on from Mayo and from the university. So I didn't want to put them on the spot on a billing question, but I think it's a wonderful question. And that is, one of the key things that I'm looking for as this deal rolls forward is how we're going to straighten out the billing issues, because this has got to be something where everybody's supported to be able to do what they need to do. And that should absolutely not be a barrier, not for any person and not for any system. We just got to get the testing. The test needs to be done. There shouldn't be any question about it being done for financial reasons. So I've got Representative Knorr and then Representative Grunhagen. And we've got about 9 minutes left if we want to end it too. We don't have to, but I would like to give people an opportunity to get on that, to listen to the 2 o'clock presentation if we can. So Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you so much to Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff. My question is in two parts. Number one, Chair Liebling just mentioned the undocumented individuals who are fearful of seeking any help because someone told them that Executive Order 20-34, that the Department of Health will share that information with the federal agencies. That's the first one. The second one is to follow up with Representative Schultz. She asked about the tracing. This is a matter of speed in terms of utilizing what Mayo had already developed. Mayo had indicated a few weeks back that they have developed a tracing app, and I think it's something that we need to look into so that we can expedite that process. So those are my two quick questions. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, we do not care about someone's status from a public health perspective. We care about, are they infected with the disease? Are they receiving the care that they need? And who are their contacts? So from our perspective, we want to make sure that everyone has access to the healthcare they need. Everyone has access to the testing they need, and that we do not share individual data, personalized data with the federal government. We share aggregate data. So we say these many people were tested and these many people tested positive, and here's some of the underlying conditions that they had. But we would never say to the federal government, Representative Knorr had X test and had X result, or Dan Huff had this test and this result. It would be, we had a, for example, it'd be we had a Caucasian male who is, you know, in the late 40s that had these underlying conditions and da-da-da-da. So it would never be identified as an individual, and then we don't track immigration status at all at NPH from that perspective.
Representative Knorr?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to get a clear picture. The Executive Order 2034 was authorizing first responders, public safety officials, 911 dispatchers to have access to information about specific residency of an individual who has contracted the COVID-19. It's something that many people, when they heard about that, decided they don't want to seek help, because that may jeopardize their status, because that's already in an executive order.
Mr. Huff, I thought there was an opt-out provision also with that executive order. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, I apologize. I missed misunderstood the question. I didn't realize which executive order you were referring to. So my apologies. So there are some really there's some pretty strict guardrails on how that data are shared with law enforcement. So what happens is it is provided to dispatch, and if there's a call, dispatch is trained to say, is anyone symptomatic or have COVID, been tested positive for COVID? Then when they tell, say, the first responder, whether it be police or EMS or fire, they just say, hey, someone has symptoms of COVID there, you should do your PPE. Now, the first responder doesn't know, did the person respond yes to the questions, or was it because of data that was provided to dispatch that says someone in this residence has tested positive? So the first responder does not know why they've been told to make sure they have PPE, but just that because of one of these couple of reasons. Because we are very concerned about data privacy, but we're also concerned about protecting public safety and protecting our frontline first responders. I don't know if that answered your question. If not, we can do some follow-up to give you some more specifics on that.
We'll follow up later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Knorr. So we have now Grinhagen, and then we're going back to members who've asked other questions. We have Representative Franson and then Representative Moran. I think Representative Moran will be the last one because we're kind of running out of time here. So, and members also, just let me put in a plug. If you have questions that aren't answered, if you would send them to me or to Mr. McQuillan, we will gather together the remaining questions and submit them to the department and try to get answers for all of us. So Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thanks to the testifiers and to you, Madam Chair, for having this meeting. I've got two quick questions. The first one is, to what degree will testing help hospitals return to what's considered to be non-essential surgeries now? I have constituents in excruciating pain, like shoulder surgery or knee or hip surgery, and they can't get scheduled. Also, I had some emails from outside my district about women with breast cancer who can't get the proper treatment on that. So will this testing, and maybe the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic might be able to answer this, will this testing actually help allow these hospitals to open up to what's considered to be non-essential surgery? And we're, with the current system, and they're ready for the COVID-19 patients to come in, but they're not coming in. So they're sitting there, and they're a lot of them are being financially stressed with this current situation. So does the testing allow hospitals at some point in the near future to do these so-called non-essential surgeries?
So let's just start with Mr. Huff to kind of get the general on that. And then I see Dr. Killeen and Dr. Pritt are kind of shaking their heads too. Oh, Dr. Pritt wants to address it. We'll go to her.
Hello, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I think that that's an excellent point about using testing to help hospitals begin to open up for folks that have a real need for a surgery, and yet it may not be considered urgent or emergent. So at Mayo Clinic, we have started implementing a testing process where patients are tested several days before a procedure, and we're starting to open up the more elective type procedures with the goal of being fully up by August, by the summer, ramping things up about 20% each month. I should note that testing is done, though, in concert with all of the other things we've heard about, including social distancing, masking, hand hygiene, and a series of questionnaires and temperature taking when the patients do arrive. So it's part of our toolkit, but it's not the only thing we're relying on.
Okay, great. Dr. Killeen?
Follow-up?
Yes, please. Oh, Dr. Killeen is going to respond as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grinhagen. I was going to say that I sympathize enormously with what you're describing, the plight of these patients, you know, a woman with breast cancer who's not able to get in for surgery at this point. And we are going the same direction that Dr. Pritt described at Mayo, which is testing patients before the surgery, but also testing staff working in the operating rooms to be sure that everybody is free of the virus or to understand their immune status. It's a critical point to getting healthcare back to non-COVID patients is to open up operating rooms, also imaging, interventional radiology, GI, I mean, the whole swath of medical care that currently is in itself in many ways under lockdown.
All right. Well, thank you very much
for
that.
Okay, a follow-up question?
We'll represent Grünhagen quickly, and then we need to finish up here.
So can I tell my rural hospitals that this is starting to open up and that with proper testing, they can do these so-called non-essential surgeries, which seem awful essential to the patient, okay? Can I tell my local hospitals that they can go ahead and start doing this if they've got the proper testing?
So Representative Grünhagen, I think that's more of a question about compliance with the executive order, and I'm going to let Mr. Huff respond to that rather than go back to our two experts. Mr. Huff, can you answer?
Madam Chair, Representative, that executive order is still in effect. However, we are working right now with the Hospital Association into how do we utilize testing now and how do we begin to free up healthcare to be able to resume some of these procedures. One of the challenges we have to remember with this is we have limited PPE. Limited masks, limited gowns, limited face shields. We know that we will be having additional cases. We have not peaked yet in Minnesota, and we will. And we need to make sure that we have the capacity when that arrives. So it is a difficult issue. There is not an easy answer, but we are diving into that and really letting the healthcare and the hospitals take the lead in helping develop a plan of how do we use the power of testing and begin to open up and loosen these restrictions on elective surgeries.
And
yeah,
Mr.
according
Huffin,
to Minnesota Gov.
Oh, go ahead, Representative.
According
ahead.
To Minnesota Gov, there's quite a bit of PPE in storage in almost every area but gowns, and I understand gowns is something hospitals need. But I say the sooner the better, because the rush of patients into these rural hospitals is not happening, and they're laying off nurses and staff and cutting back their hours. It's turning into a disaster in the rural area. So the sooner we modify that or repeal that executive order and allow local hospitals to have that discretion, the better. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just to be clear, and Mr. Huff, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that the order concerning what is an essential surgery, what is essential is really up to the doctor, I think. So if a doctor is saying this person is in pain and they need their surgery now, I think that my understanding is that was an exception to the order. That's considered an essential surgery. Is that your understanding, Mr. Huff, of the state of things right now?
Madam Chair, I don't have the executive order in front of me right now, but yes, we have to rely upon the clinical discretion of physicians, because it's not our job to say what is or is not essential. However, and I would just reiterate that we are working closely with the healthcare associations, and our care groups. Have them develop the guidance so that we can do this right.
All right. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
okay, Representative Grünhagen, I think I need to move on here because we're kind of over our time. If that's okay, did you have something you need to say or can
yeah,
we?
Yeah, just one more comment. According to my patients, they're told they can appeal with their doctor, but the appeal goes nowhere. So there's something blocking up the system here. And these people, some of them are on severe pain pills. And one guy said he didn't think he's going to live another week. So, you know, I'd certainly appreciate if Mr. Hutter would look into this and start making some modifications, especially out in the rural area where there's just they don't have any patients and they're cutting back their staff. It's reaching right. a crisis standpoint. Thank you, Madam right. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. So, Representative Moran, you are next, and you'll be the last question in this hearing. And as I said, please, members, feel free to submit questions. And I know there are lots of them left, and there will be more coming up as time goes on. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Liebley. Assistant Commissioner Huff, you know, I'm really excited that the governor has opened up this pathway for more testing. And I'm thinking that one of the reasons he did that will be that he do not want to have barriers being in place for people to be tested. So when I look at populations like the homeless populations, like communities of color, who may not have access to health care, and I'm hearing it's tied to whether your providers, whether or not you can get access to testing, that would be a problem. So I was looking at, you know, the federal government, and I thought at some point I heard the federal government said we're going to provide free testing. And through the Family First Coronavirus Act and the CARES Act, we would stay codified this language so that they can create a pathway for free testing. Do you know whether or not this is so within the Family First Coronavirus Act and the CARES Act that money has been provided for free testing, that no, that there should be no barriers in place for one to get tested?
Mr. Huff?
There.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, we have not been given the mechanism from the federal government. We have heard that from the administration, but we have not seen the mechanism with which that would be achieved.
And so with the $36 million that the governor has allocated for free testing, is that just to hire more people, or is it to create access for free testing?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, you're asking about the agreement right now, the agreement?
$36 million that the governor set aside.
I can't answer that question right now because I know that we're, part of this is to do hotspot testing, and part of it is, I think this is sort of those details we're working through. So for example, you mentioned the people experiencing homelessness. You know, that's going to be a collaborative process, and it will involve this agreement that was announced yesterday, but it's also, we're going to have to make agreements with the FQHCs, with folks like Hennepin Healthcare, with local public health to make sure that we're getting the access, really the community-based access that we need for these populations so that they can get tested. So I can't give you the specifics on how much of that money will go to that. We can look at that, but there's a lot more to figure out and operationalize.
All right, that's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative Moran. I wonder if Dr. Colleen Dr. Pritt would like to weigh in. I know you might not be prepared to talk about the money flow. That's not really your area of expertise, but if you'd like to weigh in on it, I certainly would entertain that. Dr. Colleen?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't claim to understand hospital billing and coding, but what I do see in the agreement that was approved by the governor and by the state was that the cost, I'm looking for it here, the cost agreed upon cost was $62 for the molecular and $33 for the serology. So that's $95 for the two, which, and that includes the cost of transporting specimens if necessary from the collection site to the testing site. So that's the actual number that was agreed to.
Thank you. So I hope that contract will be made available to the committee, and I assume that it will be public, but I haven't seen that yet. But I think that it does cover the cost of at least a certain amount of testing. But I think there is some mystery to this still, at least mystery to me about exactly how all of this is gonna happen and how we're gonna smooth it out. But I know that that is the intention. Dr. Pritt, did you have something you wanted to add? You don't have to if you're not prepared to speak that. Okay, very good. Well, I think that this has been really helpful. Thank you so much to Mr. Huff for answering all of these questions. And thank you, members, for your good questions. And thank you to Dr. Killeen, Dr. Pritt, for being here and helping us out as well. So I hope that you can all get a chance to go. We're a bit late, but go and hop on the presentation that should be happening right now. And thank you all. We are adjourned.